Accession number 10165, reel number 44.
Martin McLean, reel 44. You were telling me about the sudden move back to Armanagar by train.
The whole of the district, you could see troops marching. As long as the roads were, you could see troops the full length of the roads and all different regiments of the division on the move. And these Indian transport people picked us up and took us to a station where we embarked on the train for Armanagar. Arrived at Armanagar, it was a march to the camp, and then everything seemed to work so swiftly and so methodically to get ready for the move off to war. The object was for every man to pack his own individual kit, such as walking out battle clothing, and anything he'd bought as private purchases. We packed them all away, and they kept at brigade headquarters, which brigade headquarters is the actual dump at the camp where we were leaving from. After which we just took our warlike kit, our small packs, all our weapons, all ammunition, everything appertaining to war, and the next thing was we were marching back to Armanagar for to go off to, as we were told then, for Kohima. Dimapo was the real head we had to make for. We worked well in the night. Lights were burning all over the camp, as the officers' mess, the sergeants' mess, and the all other places folded up and packed up, ready for the move off. And at first light next morning, after arriving in at Armanagar, we're on the move once again, ready for to go off to war. I never did get me bed back off the company commander, because we had discussed it on the march out of the jungle. I said, "You owe me." He started laughing. He says, "Right." I never did get it, because that poor man was dead in a very short while afterwards. I'll conclude the thought. As soon as the battalion was ready to move off, no arrangements had been made about trains. We were just told to report to Armanagar Station. We set off marching. Now, for some time we had been training as amphibious troops, as I explained, and we'd sorted out our army equipment to carry our loads in a more suitable condition as to what we had in the previous days. For instance, everybody wore the small pack on their back with the straps catching underneath the shoulder, which contained in there the ground sheet, the water bottle, and also the mess tin. The mess tin is the thing we used for feeding with, an oblong piece of aluminium. For some time we'd been experimenting to get rid of the pack, because when you're laying low and ground undercover, on the ground undercover, the packs could be seen sticking up above the man, so they were a giveaway. So it had been decided to dispense with this, not only for this keeping undercover business, but for amphibious operations. We had brought back the water bottle to carry it on the left-hand side, like we used to do in the old days, by using the straps from our equipment to hang it on the side. And we tried many ways to fix up the carrying of the mess tin. And one day I was clarting on with it, and I found out that if I put me knife, fork, spoon, razor, comb, leather brush, toothpaste, and you know, whatever we had in the way of cleaning equipment inside of the mess tin, inside the smaller half, put the other half on top, we had a complete container of the stuff that we carried, essential cleaning equipment. And the handle hangs down, and it's like a handle that you use for to get your food on, and the tin hangs forward. Slide the handle down the back of the belt and secure it with a boot lace. Well, we always carried a spare boot lace or two. Secure the handle down there, and the whole idea was adopted by division. Is a very convenient place. So we're now carrying our mess tin on our right rump. So the water bottle left side, right side, and then we were laden up with our ammunition. All magazines had been filled up by the men who were waiting for movement while the preparations were made for the general move out, getting rid of the admin ways.
You didn't take a small pack at all, then?
Didn't take a small pack at all. I'm saying that. I cannot exactly remember. I know that's how we marched out in amphibious order. We had dispensed with the rubber boots and we now had ammunition boots on. Ammunition boots is the army name for the heavy hobnailed infantry type of boots, which is common with all the army them days. We set off marching off to Ahmednagar, and we landed on the station, and there, lo and behold, you know, just to show how unprepared we were and how so worried the Indian government was about this invasion into India, that the railway, there was no train on the station when we arrived there, and they could only take the express type of train, the big Pullmans, because they had to travel 6 or 7 days. The smaller trains run local, they let them go. But the railway staff, the Indian railway staff, most likely the station master, and the RTO, the railway transport officer staff, they stopped an express going through Ahmednagar, chased all of the Indians off the train and put us on. So in other words, we weren't on a troop train, we were on an ordinary train, living in the rough type of quarters, the wooden seats and what have you. There's one or two better class seats where the, I should imagine, the officers got, made no difference to us. We just got on this train and off we went. The whole line seems to be cleared for us for this particular rush through India, because we went through it at a much quicker rate than we did previously when we went up to the Arakan. The train seemed to travel non-stop until such a time as I had to stop for water and for coaling, or change of engine, or for maintenance. It was during one of these times that we found that we were in compartments now where, you know, they're just individual compartments. There's no corridor trains, and the men had to be fed somehow. So the only answer was, on one of these stops, we got tins of biscuits given to us by the CQ mess or the quartermaster, I don't know which, and we just slung so many tins of biscuits or packs of biscuits into a compartment for the men, and also a few tins of corned beef. That was your lot. Do what you can. And when a train stopped at some station or for to take on water, everyone would jump, well, not everyone would jump out. Little parties detailed from each platoon would dash out with a container, one of the tea containers. There'd be dry tea in there, and they'd get the engine driver to turn on his water outlet thing at the bottom of the engine, and they'd get it used to pour the boiling water out, like the overflow, but they could pull a lever and let boiling water run out. And we used to make a tea from the engine, it's boiling water, we used to use that, carry it back in the compartment, quickly dish it out, and the train would move off again, all within a short while. It was on one of these times when we were pulled up for apparently a long halt in some sort of junction. Maybe to change crew, maybe to change engines, or to do some maintenance, I don't know. But we were told that we could get out and stretch our legs, that there was a place where the men could swim away up the line. This was information given to the commanding officer by the local railway people. And so we went off for a swim, grabbed a towel, bare pelt, you know, bare pelt is just when with trousers and boots, and off we shot up to this place to have a swim. Had a swim, and we're told not to be long. The men I took up, mainly from my company, I turfed them out, which means get them out of the water and get them dressed and get them back to the train, because trains were, you couldn't depend on them, how long they'd be waiting for you or not. So I wanted the men back soon. Back we all went and went on to the, is it working? We all went back to the train, and on our way back, Lieutenant Wilson and another officer passed us, and they were dressed in shorts, and all they had on was their shorts, bare legs, boots, and a towel each. And we always, although I said we respected the officers with the respect they were entitled to, there was always a bit of joking and what have you. Hey, you're going to be late, sir. Want to get a move on? And this sort and the other. We'll be all right, they said. We get back on the train, and all of a sudden the train starts off without Lieutenant Wilson and this other person. And we are shouting and trying to tell the CO that there's two officers left. The CO knew about it. He says, can't do anything about it. The train's got to go. So we left two officers. And the train hurtled on right up towards Calcutta. And in the region of Calcutta somewhere, I don't know, the train stopped. And we saw our first Americans. The American railway people took over the train for a run. The driver, they called them the engineer, and the guards. And they took over the train and made the train move even faster. There was one time the train stopped in a station while something was happening, I don't know which. And this just tells you the difference between the Americans and the British. The commanding officer said, it's time the men had something to eat. CQMSs, get the mess tins out, get the containers out. On the station, prepare something hot for the men. Hot was very easy. They had tins of stew that just heated up and would get it in the mess tins. The cookers, which were petrol blow lamps, were burning away merrily. And I was standing beside the cookhouse at the time by my company commander. We were chatting away. And I heard the railway guard come up the CO and said, he pulled his watch out and looked at it and says, what's all this going on here? Command officer says, we're stopping for a short while to feed the men. He says, well, if you're not on the train within 2 minutes, he says, we move off with or without you. He says, this train's leaving in 2 minutes from now. So all the stuff had to be slung overside onto the railway line, and everything slung back on the train. And the train did leave on time, 2 minutes. Now, under normal conditions, a command officer and a British guard would chat it over, and some arrangement would have been made, but not the Americans. They were in charge, and nobody was going to interfere with them.
Were there any other troops besides the Durhams on the train?
Oh, only the Durhams on this train. You've got to look at this way. Nearly about 800 men in each battalion. So we had 9 battalions in the division. Without the Royal Artillery, the engineers, the medical corps, and all the other corps troops that were, and the signals. So there's a lot of trains required for this lift up. I learned later on that one brigade of the 2nd Div had been airlifted to Dimapur, just in case the Japanese did break through. I don't know which one it was. I did know, but I forgot, let's put it that way. And the others all had to be transported by rail. We landed it across, I think we travelled across the water on a rail ferry. The train was on a ferry, and we crossed the Brahmaputra and landed up on the other side. I remember lying low down on the river bank, and the train pulling off this barge or boat, whatever it was. You've got to imagine this way. We were getting tired, you know, with the train and what have you. And maybe I was drowsy at the time and I couldn't remember. But I remember so clearly the yard where we pulled into. It was a big marshalling yard, apparently run by Americans. They had floodlights all over the place, lots of railway lines, lots of trucks, lots of engines pushing here, rushing there, all over the shop. They drew us off this train, off this ferry boat, onto the land, and pulled us forward a bit. And then the command officer was sent for. Somebody gave him information as to what was happening. Apparently we were going to go straight through to Dimapur. Dimapur was a railhead further forward, which is the main line, the main base, which supplied Kohima and all other places, which I'll describe in a short while. But the Japanese had got across the line somewhere on the road to Dimapur. They'd been seen on the line. They don't know whether they'd formed a roadblock or anything. So the idea was that instead of the engine pulling the train, it would push the train. And that way you had to stay in the train with all our equipment on, and weapons, rifles, Bren guns, Sten guns, sticking out of the window of the vehicle in case of ambush and ready to get out at a moment's notice. The command officer had a bugler with him, which he would have given the orders for the train and get out and do this, that and the other. If we'd run into an ambush, would have got out in any case. So we had not an unpleasant journey through to Dimapur. It was very interesting. We travelled at night, and then as the daylight was breaking, we saw what sort of countryside we were going into. And it was really nice to look at. Beautiful green fields. And common with the area that we're in, you see a green field, and all of a sudden you see a great hill rising up from it with steep sides, and seemed to be like a thimble stuck on the ground. Thimbles, but a large thimble, and covered in greenery, and the whole place looked really pleasant and nice. As we come towards Dimapur, we're told that we're coming towards the place. All over the place was broken railway trains, broken carriages, broken trucks, mainly trucks, just pushed off the line. Apparently the Americans weren't satisfied with the Indian type of railway things that were going. They were having a lot of trouble with them. So when a one broke down, apparently they just pushed them off the line and used their own stuff, which they'd brought from America, which was quicker and stronger and more efficient, as they said. The reception at Dimapur, when we arrived there, was you had to see it to believe it. It was like, instead of having the Indian beggars there, there was loads of people there, officers, different sorts, begging for help to go and defend their little, their ordinances, their workshops and what have you. For instance, the ROC had a big dump there. The Royal Engineers had a dump, Indian engineers, and the hospitals and all this sort of thing in the area. Well, Japs had been seen in the area, and they wanted to borrow fighting troops to go and defend them. Now, this is where I really get my back up this. They're all fighting troops. Their secondary job is their trade that they do. But they wanted infantrymen to go and guard them while they just got on with their normal duties of looking after vehicles. I don't know, the British Army got the impression all through that a technician looking after vehicles or stores was more important than an infantryman who was got to do the fighting. They tried to borrow from the command officer troops to go and guard them, guard the areas whilst we were waiting for further instructions. One company did go off. It was either A or B company to an ordnance depot where some Japs had been seen in the locality. They went more for to sort out the Japs than to guard this place, and they were away overnight. I understand that when they came back from the ordnance place, they came back with new shirts and that had been given by the ordnance people because they could write them off. You know, it was done in an area where stores were more or less dispensable. We were given something to eat at this place and to drink. Next order was my company had got the instructions, my company commander got instructions to move forward to take up a defensive position on the main Kohima Dimapur Road. And so off we marched in the same normal manner. Open order, as we call it, on each side of the road, because transport was travelling back and forward and there was a lot of confusion in the area at the time. And we marched out of Dimapur, and there's a huge hill on our right which we walked up and were shown by the people who had prepared, who was organising the thing, where we had to take over and defend. We had a good look at the area and decided where to site our weapon pits and defence positions, and also company HQ and all this appertaining to a company. We went into the all-round defensive position. During this time of getting the positions prepared, it was essential that the forward positions get prepared first. If the Japs were in the area, they could attack at any time. The platoons, who were the outer perimeter of our own defence, had to be left alone entirely while they dug trenches, and they, with their entrenching tools. We had no heavy Royal Engineer equipment there. Royal Engineer equipment means the GS shovels and the picks and that sort of stuff. What we had for to make out our trenches with was the small entrenching tool, which wasn't ideal for this job we had in hand, but we got so used with them, we could really move the earth with it, and using our helmets to scrape out earth as well. So it was with the entrenched tool and the helmets that the company set to make defensive positions. At this time, Roger Stock, Major Roger Stock, sent for me and said, "Sarmage, collect some men. I want you to go forward on patrol here. I want you to go along the point of this hill and all around this area and come back with any information you can give me." We had been stuck on this hill was more or less astride the Kohima Dimapur Road, and we thought we'd be right up at the point overlooking on Kohima, but we weren't. We were put right at the back end of the hill. Well, to me it was a bad defensive position, because you're given the high ground in front of you and the top of the hill to the Japanese, but that's where we were told to defend, and there's nothing more we could do about it. I went forward with the patrol, keeping under cover as the chaps had been seen in the area.
How many men on the patrol?
About six. Only six and me, seven. Somewhere in that region, just take a few men. It was what I call a reconnaissance patrol. In the army, you had a reconnaissance patrol consisting of about six men. And then you'd have a fighting patrol consisting of a full platoon. A fighting platoon was generally, its job was to go and bring in prisoners. But a reconnaissance patrol only consisted of a leader and so many men for involvement. You know, if you got involved, one would get away. You always had a getaway man to pass on information. As I told you in a previous case, the getaway men were detailed and the points were detailed. The points are men who go forward first and scout around, scout in front of them to see there's nothing, you know, not going to run an ambush. It's a slow process, really. And we didn't have much room to manoeuvre around because we're right on top of the hill, which is rather steep on each side. The scouts in front waved to me that there was something up in front. And I moved further up, and we had a Bren gun group with us, by the way. And there's some people there, and they looked all the world like Japanese. They were digging trenches at the far end. And something prompted me not to open fire on them. In other words, maybe I was a bit cautious. Like I said before, I was overcautious. You cannot go shooting people up if it's more than a company strong and there's only six of you, because you're then in trouble. Our job was to find out what was happening and bring the information back. And we lay there a few moments watching these people digging in, and then I saw a bush hut, a Gurkhas type of bush hut. And then I realised who they were, so we got up and made ourselves known and walked in. And it was a platoon of Gurkhas. They had been sent in but with their British officer to take up the defence on the other end of this hill. So both ends of the hill were tied up. The Gurkhas were digging in, and they were pleased to see us, little dark lads. We'd met up with them. They'd been teaching us jungle law back in Belgaum for a very brief period before we moved off for this battle. Not them particular ones, but we had an officer who had been wounded in previous battles who'd been sent to teach us jungle law, and his Gurkha people were telling us what you could eat and things, which we never did put to any effect because we could never find the stuff that they found. The little Gurkhas were quite pleased to see us, and I reported the company command, the platoon commander, and told them what was happening. And in the meantime, the Gurkhas rustled up a Dixie of tea for the lads. And we sat and chat with this platoon commander and explained what was happening. He explained what he had to do so I could give a full report to the company commander. And sitting around us at this time, so you have the Gurkhas digging in, me and this platoon commander sitting on a mound of earth that had been freshly dug, chatting away with a cup of tea, and sitting around, just in the background, like in the back kitchen, was a group of black people with red blankets around them, squatting on the hunkers, and they were the most ferocious and weird-looking type of black person, who'd been used with the Indians, but I'd never met these type before. They were worth looking at. They had some had shaved the head right off the side, and they had a bunch of hair sticking up at the top, just like the Mohicans, just a crest of hair sticking up like a comb, and others had different types of hairdressing. But in the main, the sides of the hair, the head was shaved clean of hair. On their legs, they had massive, strong legs, and they had black bangles tied around the leg. Or black laces, we don't know what they were. But they were definitely ornamented up with these black things and on the wrists as well. So I asked the officer who they were. He says, oh, they are the local natives. He says, go around and have a look, and I'll tell you more about them later on. Well, we weren't in any great rush. We were there for a few days. So I went and had a look at the huts where these people lived. They were just like an igloo, a mud igloo. Pretty strong stuff. Not compared like the Indians had, where they were flimsy and could be pushed over. These things couldn't be pushed over. And they had a strong wooden door sealing the whole of the front of this little igloo thing. You had to duck to get in. Not that we went in, but to get in you'd have to duck. So the door would be about 3.5 foot tall and very solidly built. And hanging outside of some of them was something, a rope or leather, I don't know what it was, containing a group of heads and skulls, and they were like monkey skulls. You know what? Yes, we've seen often dead monkey, just like monkey skulls lying around. We had a look at them, and these people were following us around with their blankets, wondering what they were doing. They were looking at us in amazement. Maybe it was the first British troops they'd seen, I don't know. We went back to the officer, fine young lieutenant, and he start laughing when I was telling about the monkey's heads hanging on there. He says, they aren't monkey's heads, they are real heads. He says, you're now looking at the Assam headhunters, famed throughout the world. They fight with their own people, not with their own relatives, but other people in the area, and have little wars, and they shrink their men's skulls. When they kill a person, they shrink their skulls, and that's a sign of the man's claims, he's killed them people. And we were rather taken back with this, and these big fellas were looking down at us, and apparently the officer told us, he says, when you meet these chaps, he says, always tell them to sit. He says, don't let them stand. He says, they're so muscle-bound in the legs through climbing all these cuds and mountains and hills that the legs are so overdeveloped that it's uncomfortable for them to stand up. They walk, they always climb the hills at a crouch. So that was our introduction, the Assam headhunters, who, after a short while, turned out to be great people for us. They absolutely worked like Trojans later on. For instance, British troops found it difficult climbing up hills with all their 76 pound on, without carrying stretchers, without carrying ammunition. We had to do it, of course, but to ease the burden, the deputy commissioner of the area, who was an Englishman, called all the Assam headhunters in the area, who are willing to work. I don't make no story on this. I actually saw this big assembly of these Assam headhunters, all different shapes and sizes, and they didn't have the red blankets with them. Now, the officer told me they'd been given them red blankets, which were hospital blankets, army hospital blankets, by the people that were surrounded in Kohima for the good work they'd done in helping them to get some jobs done. That was their reward.
Were they friendly? You said they were astonished and amazed.
There's no... We didn't have to do any conversing with them. But they seemed friendly enough. But they were looking as strange as we were looking at them, strangely.
And how many were there at this gathering, about?
There'd be about 20 in this little village on top of the hill.
No, when they had the gathering...
There's hundreds of them. Whilst I'm on that, I might as well tell you what they're doing. They were having difficulty carrying wounded down hills, or carrying wounded. They wanted men to carry stuff, and these were just the men they carried, ammunition, loads and all sorts. Well, unbeknownst to me, they were at the same time arranging one of the columns of the infantry, the reconnaissance corps that we had in the division, and another couple of battalions to go right around the back of Kohima, and they had to travel carrying all their loads and equipment and stuff to ambush and come round the back of the Japs to try to drive them off the hill in a two-pronged attack. One going to the front, the other going around the rear. And they were using these Indians to carry the loads of equipment and stores. I don't know what the whole plan was, but they were deployed to help the British troops in the area, carrying stores, carrying equipment, carrying ammunition and stuff. We had very little dealings with them at this stage because we were forward troops. We went down to this hill. Now, we arrived in Dimapur on the 4th of April, and the Div Commander, Lieutenant General Grover, now Major General Grover, he wouldn't allow us to be sent forward and do action, because although we had travelled up by train and were infantry in defensive positions around Dimapur, all the division hadn't arrived yet because they had to get other trains to get the corps troops up, to get the others up. Apart from which, all the Royal Artillery and all engineers and carriers and track vehicles and all that sort of thing that we had on division strength had to come up by road, 1,700 miles on Indian roads. And he wouldn't commit his men into any sort of action. And at such a time as he had the 3-inch mortars, and he had the guns and support weapons and the necessary stuff to do battle with.
So you stayed on this hill?
And we stayed on this hill for all this length of time.